Good morning and welcome to Community Conversations here on 88.5 KRFY. I'm today's host, Chris Bessler. We're at the last day of the year 2020, and it's certainly been proof, to borrow from that old saying, that we live in interesting times. Today is our year in review show, and we take a look back at some of the big stories of 2020 with three local journalists from the Daily Bee and the Sandpoint Reader. They give the local angle on news of the year, such as the pandemic, how the Black Lives Matter unrest played out here, the elections, and more. We recorded this conversation 2 days before airtime, and it's been such a fast-moving news year, I'm afraid to guess what might have happened in those past 2 days. But with no further ado, here is today's community conversation.
We're speaking now with three of our local journalists. We have with us the Daily Bee news editor, Keith Kennard. Keith, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
And from the Sandpoint Reader, publisher Ben Olson. Ben, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Chris.
And news editor Lindsay Kaber. Lindsay, thank you for being here.
Hi, Chris.
So each year for KRFY's talk shows, we like to do a year in review and talk about the big stories of the past year, as well as take a peek ahead to the coming year. So that's our project this morning, which is might be a little more difficult than usual to boil the year 2020 down into 30 or 40 minutes of talk. But let's see how well we do with that. We talked a little bit in advance, and there's a few stories that are going to be on everybody's list of the biggest stories of the year for our local folks. And, of course, I think leading that list is probably COVID-19 and the entire impact the coronavirus has had on us here, both economically and socially. So let's start out with that. Now, Keith, you know, if you were going to characterize 2020 and in this particular story, what would you say about COVID-19 in Sandpoint and Bonner County?
I hate to say it, but I kind of saw it coming when I saw that we were a more permissive state and less of a restricted state. I just figured people would pour into here. And I think this summer, that's what happened, basically.
We saw people coming from Washington and other areas.
Yeah, you name it.
We're more restrictive.
Texas, Washington, California. They just poured into here. And I'm, you know, this is anecdotal, obviously, but I know somebody that worked at North 40, and he just said that people are coming in here and buying property sight unseen just to get out of where they were at, whether it was the restrictions or the virus itself.
Yeah, I actually heard that from a couple of different realtors, that they had people they were representing bidding on property that they hadn't even been in to visit yet, which just seems kind of crazy, doesn't it? I think, Ben, you could take it from that point. We are seeing an impact with people actually moving here, not just coming here to recreate, that has been spurred by the reaction to the coronavirus in other parts of the country, I guess you could say.
Yeah. I've heard from, you know, a perfect example actually was when I went downtown, it must've been a couple months ago. And I saw Doug at iCarts. He was outside kind of cleaning up the picnic tables. And so we sat down and we had a beer outside. It was nice. And he said, you know, this is the first time I've seen locals come in for a long time. All summer long, I've seen nothing but unfamiliar faces. And I think that's a perfect antidote for kind of what Sandpoint was like this summer. It was not really the town that we all kind of know and love. It was being shared with a lot of people from out of town. And like Keith said, I think people are just flooding into the area and buying up houses like crazy. I've given up looking for a house because every time I see one I like, it's gone or it's way too much. And, you know, I think that impact on locals who just want to live and work here, it's going to be seen in the coming years, I think, what it's going to produce. Because I think the people that are moving here right now, they most likely are more comfortable with their income. They're most likely remote working. I don't know if it's going to add the same community nature to town as you would if a family moves here, you know, for the husband or the wife that got a job, or they're looking for good schools, you know, the traditional reasons for moving to Sandpoint. I'm just curious what's going to happen to the dynamic of this town after this influx.
Yeah, I think there's no question we're going to see an impact that outlasts just the virus itself in terms of our economy and our, you know, our social institutions too. Let's talk about that a little bit. And Lindsay, you covered probably a lot of public meetings that the coronavirus was a matter of contention, because we do have folks that they want to be careful. You know, they want to see health protocols observed. On the other hand, we see folks that think, you know, it's all a hoax or some measure in between that. What's your take on where our locals, you know, society and culture stands on the whole, you know, masking and being careful about the viruses?
It's interesting locally because I see a good mix of responses. So there's a lot of people in between. There's a lot of people who are taking it very seriously and have been remaining in their homes, kind of like we all did back in March. They've really stuck with that regimen. Whereas on the other end, you have people who see the protocols and the guidelines as a violation of their freedoms, an overreach by government. It's an interesting time to be covering local government because you have to kind of strike a balance between covering, you know, their point of view and what they're saying, but also kind of referring back to what the guidelines are, what the protocols are, who's putting that information out. You've seen it a lot with the Bonner County Commissioners, which is the bulk of what my coverage has been. And it's just, it's different every week. So.
Yeah. And the county in particular, I mean, the commissioners had a couple of, how would you term it, statements or proclamations that were kind of in opposition to what the state's been putting out. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Back when the state was about to move into stage three of the governor's reopening plan, the commissioners actually put forth a legal complaint against the restrictions that were in stage two. And just essentially saying that what the governor was enacting and what the Department of Health and Welfare was putting out there was unconstitutional. Commissioner Bradshaw has been especially vocal about how Governor Little has not been an adequate leader during this and that he's been overreaching. So locally, you're seeing a lot of pushback against the state's guidelines, which I think can be kind of confusing for locals who are trying to navigate this. But I just hope that, you know, people understand that there's a lot of different players in this right now.
Keith, one thing I observed was it seemed early on like Bonner County was a bit of an island. We weren't seeing very many cases reported here when things were taken off, like in New York early in the pandemic. And we didn't actually see a death recorded here. I think the first death was not reported in Bonner County until mid-October. And now we're up to, you know, there's a total of, looking at the numbers from just yesterday, we have 1,876 cases total here, 593 currently active. And we now had 13 deaths in the Panhandle Health District. We've had over 15,000 cases of 4,580 are currently active. Do you think that influenced the way our locals looked at this? You know, hey, it's hardly happening here. At least it was hardly happening here at the beginning of things. And did that color the perceptions that people had?
Maybe. I know that after having written like countless pandemic stories, I always felt like the metrics weren't the most perfect. And so I think it did create an air of safety that maybe we didn't have. But yeah, I mean, I think anybody like if you were living in Spokane or Coeur d'Alene, let's go to Sandpoint. You know, there's hardly any virus up there and people aren't getting sick. And I definitely think that contributed to part of it. And that's notwithstanding all the people that came here from out of state, either just passing through to get away from restrictions or the virus, or they're coming here to live full time.
And of course, Panhandle Health District did put in place a mask mandate for the entire health district. It's required. I kind of doubt, our sheriff has even said he wasn't going to enforce it. And the city police have said that they're going to take more of an educational approach to it. I mean, you guys give me your guess on this, but I kind of doubt that's going to change. I doubt there will actually be any active enforcement of it. Anybody got a thought on that?
I think that the damage has unfortunately been done with politicizing face masks. It was done early on, and it goes all the way to President, Trump. Right early on, he basically told Americans, this is what the CDC is recommending. I'm not going to wear it. And I forget his exact words, but he essentially said it's voluntary. And he kind of set the tone early on that way. And it was unfortunate because, in this climate, in this very polarized climate, people are always looking for the next cultural battle, whether it be face masks or, what sticker you put on your bumper or whatever else. We apparently love to divide ourselves right now. And so I think that maybe if the optics and the messaging was a little bit more even keeled in the beginning, maybe face masks wouldn't have been as politicized. But then again, I kind of doubt that. I think that there's a very anti-government sort of sentiment that has been in North Idaho for a long time. And you're never really going to eradicate. I mean, it goes all the way back to Ruby Ridge and before. So unfortunately, the damage was done with that. And a mask mandate, while it would have been great, before the spikes in the third wave and that kind of stuff, it might have helped save some lives. I don't think it has done much to change people's outlook on whether they're going to wear face masks or not.
Well, one more observation before we move on to another topic here. The first vaccinations were given here December 18th. That's just a little over a week ago. It's interesting. On the Sandpoint Online Facebook page, there, we posted the pictures of the folks at Bonner General Health getting the vaccination. And it was interesting. There were quite a number, as on any Facebook post, a lot of people looking for something to argue about. There were quite a number of people that were really poo-pooing vaccinations and questioning these folks that are on the front line, that are exposed to the virus every day, whether they should even be getting the vaccination. So I guess the good news is, though, the vaccinations are happening now in Idaho. As of yesterday, there had been 10,459 doses of the coronavirus vaccine administered around the state. I don't know, you guys got any insights on the numbers that we're getting here? I know we had those first doses. Lindsay?
Yeah, I covered the governor's town hall phone call, AARP phone call last week, and almost every person who called in to ask a question was curious what the queue is going to be like. As far as, right now we've got healthcare workers being vaccinated. I think also a part of this round is people in long-term care facilities as well as people who work in long-term care facilities. So the task force that's kind of putting that queue together, that's, portion 1A, and then 1B, they're talking about vaccinating teachers, daycare workers, and people who their job forces them to interact with the public. but that's really, really broad. And so I'll be interested to see moving forward how they actually define that, how they put that information out. And what I'm also learning is that most people, unless it's done through a special program, can receive the vaccine from their regular avenues. So, you know, go to the CVS, go to the Safeway. But those details are already, they're in the works. They're not solidified yet.
Okay. Well, that certainly has to be the biggest story of the year, COVID-19 and the coronavirus.
I would like to add one quick thing that sure. I think is quite interesting. We did a story, I think it was back in 2018, about Bonner County ranking second in the nation for vaccine exemptions for kids going into kindergarten. And I think that's going to come into play here when vaccines do become widespread. I'm curious to see if that is going to hold true, because we're already seeing a lot of distrust for it, and it's unfortunate. But, you know, that's quite a statistic, second in the nation.
So it's likely a lot of local residents are going to say, no, I'm not taking the vaccine, even once it becomes available.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's going to maybe, this is one of my predictions, but that's probably going to be the next battle line with COVID is, you know.
Oh, it will be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't need a crystal ball for that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, speaking of battle lines, it kind of plays into the next topic I wanted to bring up here. We saw civil unrest nationally following more shootings of innocent Black people, the Black Lives Matter movement. And we saw some of the fallout of that here locally, to be sure. Keith, what did you observe about the protests and the reaction to the protesters that we saw here locally?
Well, you know, I vividly remember it was a bunch of kids and young adults who were protesting on the Long Bridge. And Dan McDonald put out his dog whistle, which brought out a bunch of counter protesters who said they were there strictly to make sure that these kids could protest in peace. But I didn't really buy it. I think that they were there to counter demonstrate. And God bless those kids for, you know, sticking their necks out and being brave and saying what they thought. I thought it was a shame that these militia types had to turn out as though they were like threatened by a bunch of kids and young adults. I mean, it in a way, it kind of reminded me of the Stoneman Douglas shooting response, where a bunch of adults were threatened by, you know, the views of a bunch of teenagers and young adults. And I thought it was really unfortunate. And as much as they'd like to say that they were there just to make sure that no bad actors got involved, I think it was, you know, I just didn't buy it, because those people weren't there. The people that were there were just there to speak their mind. And there was no Antifa, there was no mobs, there was no, and the fact that they lingered around town that night armed, it just was unfortunate.
Lindsay, what was your take on that when we had all these armed guys hanging out around downtown, you know, ostensibly saying they're there to protect the store owners? Did you get any feedback from downtown people on what they felt about that?
You know, Ben and Zach ended up covering that, and I know Ben was familiar with what the feedback was from some of the store owners, so I'll let him speak to that.
Yeah, I did hear from quite a few business owners downtown that were quite dismayed, especially about how the militia guys kind of hung out downtown. You know, some of them in full battle dress, wearing, I mean, we counted 5 weapons on one guy. I mean, he had a long gun. He had a 2 pistols on his chest, 2 on his belt, and like enough ammo to go to war. And I just thought, if it really was about protecting the protesters, which I don't believe either, I don't know that you would have to posture like that. I don't know that you would have to dress for battle like that. As many of them say, they conceal carry for tactical reasons because they tip their hand when they're showing up, you know, open carrying. And like Keith, you know, I watched that Facebook post by Dan McDonald, you know, and it was a dog whistle. He has backtracked on it, and he said that, you know, he was just asking for Bonner County folks to come out. But it's interesting to note the rhetoric that was going on in that Facebook post. You know, you had guys saying, you know, on going to be on site in 10 minutes, on the way, we're heading out, and they were all mobilizing and they were all communicating with one another. And as Zach and I were in the courthouse parking lot, you know, and we walked up, we said, oh, just a bunch of kids, you know, these are a bunch of 15-year-olds. And
they were marching down the long, right?
They were amassing at the courthouse. There was about 50 of them that grouped at the courthouse parking lot to march across the Long Bridge. And they were holding their signs and they're high schoolers. And I saw the militia guys that showed up and they had the exact same surprised reaction. Oh, these are a bunch of kids. And I watched them pivot to saying, okay, this is all about protecting their First Amendment right to speak. We're here to protect the kids, as if they're stewards of the First Amendment that need to protect us and tell us our rights. And I think a lot of folks in North Idaho don't like to have their rights dictated to them. We often know our rights, and we don't need anybody to tell us what our rights are, because we live in a place where we celebrate our rights, First Amendment, Second Amendment, and on. And you know, me being, I am a Second Amendment supporter. I own guns, but I thought that the optics with having armed men following high schoolers across that Long Bridge, we still see the repercussions of that today. National news articles were written about it. Business owners called me, emailed me, telling me, you know, they're scared. They've never seen downtown like this before. They've had customers turn away. You know, one person said they had somebody call them and say, I wanted to come in today, but I saw these guys with guns outside, and I got a little freaked out. And I know that what the guys carrying, the militia guys, I know that their intentions were to promote their cause, promote the Second Amendment. I know that they don't have malicious intentions, but the optics were terrible, and they caused this feeling of dismay and of fear with a lot of people, because honestly, I don't want to walk downtown Sandpoint and see 30, 40 people carrying, you know, AR-15s. Yes, they have a right to do that, but I don't think that's the image that Sandpoint's going for. And I don't think that's the image that Sandpoint business owners really want to project either. We're an inclusive community. And yeah, that whole thing, it kicked off a firestorm, and we're still seeing the echoes of that right now.
Hey, Chris, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So, in the interest of full disclosure, I moved here in 1996. I'm originally from Michigan. I went to college in Montana. When I got here, I felt like there was this kind of live and let live mentality. Like, you would have somebody that was really conservative or really liberal, and everybody would just kind of, I guess, for lack of a better word, tolerate one another. And it seems over the years, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm just becoming jaded, but it seems like it's become very binary. It's one or two. And there's not, you know, that live and let live mentality. And I hope I'm wrong, but I mean, is that your observation as well? You've lived here for a while.
Yeah, I moved to the area in 78, actually. So I guess I lived here most of my life. and actually, when, you know, when I first came here as a journalist myself, I was in Bonner's Ferry before I came down to Sandpoint. Yeah, there was definitely more of that. Although, you know, hippies and the loggers were kind of at each other back in those days. you know, the loggers feeling like the hippies were coming in and impacting their livelihood because they wanted to, you know, they were proposing some wilderness areas.
Spotted owl.
Yeah, we had our version of that here. But I will say this, and a lot of folks that are moving here don't understand this. In the late 70s and early 80s, it was predominantly Democrats that were in office locally. The entire Idaho First District legislative delegation was a Democrat. In fact, Lindsay's grandfather, right? Kermit. He was in the legislature in those days as a Democrat. And the county commissioners were almost all Democrat. And that was a legacy of the fact that the Democrats up through the 60s and 70s, back into the 40s even, it was the party of workers and unions. And they were out protecting workers' rights over business rights. And that's my take on it, of course. And that started to change in the 80s. And we've seen a steady progression that's more conservative here. I think what you're talking about, though, is a phenomenon that we are seeing nationally. I mean, we're just more polarized, period, which is unfortunate. And, you know, I'd like to see everybody get back to the fact that we have a ton of common ground here, whether you're conservative or more liberal, in that we, you know, love living in this place for its special attributes. And let's figure out how to overcome these political divisions. Well, to your point, Ben or Lindsay, they've been here practically their whole lives as well, would probably say, yeah, the whole atmosphere has changed. Ben or Lindsay, you guys want to weigh in on that?
I'm just going to go back to Ruby Ridge. I think that was the catalyst. I think that after that, there was always an anti-government, you know, conservative feeling in the rural areas of Bonner County and North Idaho at large. But that's indicative of the rest of the country. But Ruby Ridge really galvanized some sort of feelings and for good reason. I think the FBI messed up pretty big time at Ruby Ridge, and then they messed up again at Waco. And they've been, you know, building their reputation back since then. But people hold grudges apparently here. and there is a sense of, and you saw that, you know, I think the term lunchbox Democrat was very popular in the kind of the 90s. Early 80s, early 90s, you know, the Jim Stoichefs, Kermit Cabrera. And then you look and you see it all flipped about mid-90s into the late 90s. And we've been Republican ever since, with our commissioners, with our state reps, with our state senators. And now we're seeing another flip where even the, you know, the vanguard kind of normal Republicans are being labeled as rhinos and too liberal for this new, you know, sect of the Republican Party, which is primarily led by Trump, and it's primarily led by ideological battles, as opposed to kind of the nuts and bolts Sean Keogh style of governance.
Yeah, and I would say Kermit and Jim Stoichef, those guys were conservative Democrats. They were really kind of in the middle on things, as you point out, even mainstream Republicans now are being labeled as flaming liberals when you wouldn't have considered that 20 years ago. So we kind of got off track there. One more question here on the whole Black Lives Matter and the civil unrest. There has been a community letter put out that's asking law enforcement, you know, to step up and, you know, ask these guys that are showing up with the militia gear to back off, because it is the domain of the law enforcement to take care of us. Are you guys familiar with that community letter that's been out there gathering signatures? I guess it's online.
Yeah, and I think that it's well it's well thought out. But I again like the mask mandate, I think that it's not going to change anybody's mind. In fact, I've seen posts on social media where some of the guys say, you know, we're just going to go out more and we're going to practice our rights more. And And that's unfortunate because I think the intended consequence is to say that we, you know, we trust and we believe in our police force, and we want them to be the ones that interact and react when there's a situation. So I think that was the intent of that letter.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's move on to, we were just talking about politics. Let's swing on over to politics. It was an election year. We had the general election. Of course, the national election was very heated, although not so much here. I mean, it was 2-1 for Donald Trump in Bonner County. And the Republicans all easily won their seats for the local races for county commissioner. I mean, one of the Jeff Connolly was not even opposed. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Bradshaw, he won by a pretty healthy margin over his Democratic challenger. So I to talk about the election here, I'd probably like to go back to the primary. And it seems like, given the current environment here that that is so heavily Republican, that most of the action takes place in the primaries. And Lindsay, let's talk about the primary election between Stephen Bradshaw and Butch Horton, two Republicans. And that's a place where Stephen Bradshaw has been a bit of a lightning rod for certain issues like mm-hmm. the gun policy at Memorial Field. But he bested Butch Horton by a pretty hefty margin.
Yeah, I think what was really interesting about this year's primary is we forget to consider how important candidates getting out into the community and meeting with people in person is. I would be willing to bet you that a lot of people by the time the election rolled around didn't even know who Butch was, because he didn't hold events. He, when I talked to him, you know, he was doing his best to responsibly meet with people. But it was a weird time in the spring, you know, not only were we all navigating COVID for the, you know, really navigating a pandemic for the first time, a worldwide pandemic, which is redundant, so I don't know why I said that. But, you know, we were also, it was all mail-in ballots. I mean, is that accurate? Wasn't it?
Yes.
The primary was? Yeah. And I think that that...
You could drop them off, but they didn't have any polling places open in the primary. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that did a lot for the familiar winning out with people who may or may not have been on the fence, you know, people who were looking for a new Republican candidate to throw their weight behind. Like, they were probably doing their own research. They were reading the Reader. They were reading the Bee, trying to get to know what their options were. But people who weren't going to put that much effort in, like, you know, maybe they didn't know who Horton was. And I thought it was just an interesting time to see how important it is during an election cycle to have those town halls, to have those in-person meetings, to have those forums and debates. So yeah, I think that played a big part.
And as I mentioned, the other commissioner, Jeff Connolly, wasn't opposed in the primary or the general election. And in the Idaho legislature, Heather Scott and Jim Woodward, the state senator and the state representative, were both unopposed in the primary. But Sage Dixon was opposed by Gary Suppiger in the Republican primary. Keith, I don't know how closely you followed the primary elections, but that's another place where Sage has been a bit of a lightning rod with some of his statements or some of his positions on things. But he easily won re-election in the primary over Suppiger.
He did, and I, you know, it's funny that I almost classified him as some of the Democrats that you were speaking of earlier, Stoychev. But I almost feel like his brand isn't like he's not extreme enough for some people out there. And, you know, Heather Scott, I mean, she just enjoys acclaim. And no matter what she does or says, I think she's always, you know, going to kind of have that cachet. And I think that's a shame. And But I do want to say that we did have a Democrat come out for sheriff, which I thought was notable. Daryl Wheeler's been in office for quite a long time. And somebody, I think she was just kind of running as a placeholder. I don't think she was, campaigning that actively, but I appreciated that she was willing to put herself out there. And, when I spoke to her after the election, I said, would you ever do this again? And she said, absolutely not. And she said it was a horrible experience. So I'm guessing that she got beat up pretty good on the campaign trail, but I always appreciated that there was another name that you could check off on your ballot and you weren't just, stuck with the same people and the same party.
And that was Cindy Marks that ran against Daryl Wheeler. Camp. I give kudos to the folks that have the courage to put themselves out there in these campaigns, because they get hit no matter what side they're on. They're gonna be under a, for one thing, their personal lives get intruded upon, and they take a lot of flack. Ben, I don't know if you have any thoughts on the election this year, which was, it's curiously the local thing was kind of low key in a way.
Yeah, it's gotten to be kind of a foregone conclusion lately. I always hesitate to generalize, especially about elections, but elections in Bonner County for the last 20 years, 20 plus years, they've generally swung to, they look for the R and they look for the familiar name, and anybody else, they have to, climb a big mountain to get over that hurdle. And like Keith said, I applaud anybody that runs. I've heard from several people that are, Republican strategists and Democratic strategists. They have the hardest time finding people to run for office because they are terrified. Anybody that crosses swords with somebody like Heather Scott, it seems like the nastier that Heather Scott is, the more her base enjoys her and thinks that she's fighting, for them. And that's unfortunate because it kind of eliminates a lot of the playing field, which is, I think, the intended consequence that they're looking for. And you really have to mess up big time as an incumbent to not take a good majority of the vote. As we've seen, Sheriff Wheeler has had some questionable statements in the past that didn't hurt him at all. Heather Scott's had some questionable statements and actions in the past that hasn't hurt her at all.
No, it's red meat. And
yeah.
Their base.
Hey, I'll throw out there, I did interview Heather Scott for the election coverage on KRFY, and she, when we got to the general election, she did lament the fact that she didn't have an active opponent, because she loses, as any candidate would, this basis for discussing her ideas, and I think she even recognizes that when there is no opponent there for her, then she doesn't really have the ability to fully explicate, where she stands on things. So,
you must not get her newsletters.
Don't worry. I get her newsletters, but in terms of standing for election and not having anybody to campaign against, I think every candidate is somewhat diminished by that, including Jeff Connolly. Jeff Connolly probably would have liked to have somebody contest him for county commissioner this year, just so he'd have some things to talk about and present himself to the voters.
Especially recently, Jeff has been the more quiet commissioner, and that's often because he is the dissenting voice on a lot of things, like the legal complaint against the governor's reopening plan. He actually voted against filing that legal complaint because he felt like, just going to court again with someone wasn't the correct course of action. And so I do my best to try to highlight Jeff's point of view in our coverage because I think it brings a different perspective to county politics. But for the most part, when I reach out to the county for comment, I hear back from Dan. So.
Yeah. And one thing about Dan is he'll engage.
Oh, yes.
He won't ignore you.
And engage.
Yeah. He's amazingly prolific in that respect. Yeah. And that's actually you know, maybe it's to a fault, and some people might say, but it's also to his credit that he'll won't just ignore you just because he has a secure political base. Okay, so we talked about three of the big stories locally. Lindsay, why don't you lead off and give us a couple other stories you thought were big this year?
Well, my pet beat that I cover almost every week for the last year and a half was the gun suit, the lawsuit between the city and the county regarding the festival at Sandpoint's gun ban policy. We got a ruling on that in early September. The judge ruled in favor of the city, basically said the county didn't have the standing to bring the case in the first place. However, there is another lawsuit regarding the exact same thing, and that is being brought by private citizens who, if you're just looking at the facts from the outside, looks like they have, you know, more of a claim than the county does. So it's going to be interesting to see the evidence and the facts come out in that case. I also think that firearms preemption is going to come up at the legislative session. I believe that Sheriff Wheeler has told me on the record that he's been working with Heather Scott. I'm not sure if he backpedaled on that, but I believe he said that they were working on something to make firearms preemption law in Idaho more clear when it comes to leases. Because, you know, the crux of the issue is the city claims it's not violating anybody's gun rights because the festival has control of public property during those 2 weeks. The festival is saying, well, the festival, I guess, really hasn't said anything because it was between the city and the county. But the county is alleging, you know, no matter who's doing it, it's violating constitutional rights. Idaho code is a little more difficult to interpret, and the judge in that case didn't actually end up ruling on the issue of law. He only ruled on the issue of standing. So that's going to continue to be a big story in 2021 as well.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that. Corollary to that one, we just learned that Ali Baranski has been named the executive director of the festival at Sandpoint. What do you think that portends for a festival in 2021, the whole mess we have with this dispute over guns at Memorial Field?
Well, a lot of what the county's complaint ended up being was that they needed a ruling on the issue of law to avoid basically a riot at the festival gates if they keep up with this gun ban policy. The judge ended up describing that argument as vague. He was not convinced, but I've been talking to the county's lawyer with Davila Law Group, Amy Clemens, and she maintains that it's going to continue to be a danger. She believes that people are going to protest. She believes that it could become violent, and there's been a lot of discussion about that. And so whatever happens in 2021, whether there's a festival, whether there's a ruling, it's just going to keep, we're just adding layers to the cake, basically.
It's a pretty needless fight, if you ask me, and it's very unfortunate, and it's a shame is what it is, because the festival has always been something that people have been able to enjoy and without having politics inserted into it, and it's, you know, pandemic notwithstanding, I think it's, you know, one of the worst things. Like, can you pick a fight somewhere else other than the festival, because all they're trying to do is put on a show. They're not trying to be political. They just want people to have a good time. And then people insert themselves into this problem that doesn't even really exist. So I have some strong feelings, and sorry about that.
I agree with you, Keith. I think that it's a problem that does not exist on many levels. It's interesting that whole idea of, you know, the Davalier using that idea of armed protesters showing up at the festival, and that's why they need a ruling on this, because it could turn violent. And they're using that as a very big cudgel in their argument. And I just think that's fascinating, because the same exact protesters, i.e. militia guys, were all over social media in June saying, that there's no violence in them amassing to protect these First Amendment activists. They're there to protect. They're not there to create violence. They're safe. They know they're trained. And I just think it's odd how they play they play those two off one another. you know, it's potential for violence when it involves the festival, but there's absolutely no violence possible when it involves, you know, BLM protesters. But the larger point is the festival brings in millions of dollars to this community every year. It adds a cultural stamp to Sandpoint. It has been a part of my life since I was a child hanging off the chain link fence, listening to like the Beach Boys and, you know, Johnny Cash.
I was there on the outside of that fence for Johnny Cash
too. Yeah. I mean, it is one of the biggest cultural outputs that Sandpoint creates. And to have a very small minority of people to have the audacity to try to take that down is the biggest shame of this year locally to me, you know, in another arena than COVID. I think that they should have left it alone. I think that they should, if they care so much about jobs and they care so much about economic vitality of our county and our town, I don't know how many jobs are created by the festival, but I know that, you know, there are numbers that support $4 to $5 million plus that comes into our community every single year. That's not coming in now and potentially could be at harm. And one of my sort of doom struck predictions is that with this this preemptions possibly being debated and potentially a bill coming out of legislature, I think that the festival may have to move from Memorial Field if they're going to, you know, change the goalposts in Boise in order for ISAA to win this second lawsuit. And I think what we're going to see is the festival is not going to have a home at Memorial Field anymore. And I know that I'm going to be pretty disappointed to see that happen because it has to move to private property so that people can enjoy a concert without, you know, having guns in the audience. And the bands that play can have their contracts honored, and, you know, the festival can go off as usual. I hope that doesn't happen. I think that the festival and Memorial Field live together in this beautiful symbiotic kind of relationship. But I fear that that's going to be the outcome.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic that we build a 1500 seat grandstands, beautiful construction there. Very specifically to accommodate a crowd like that, and yet the biggest event that's held there may have to move away. Keith, you want to say something?
I was just going to crack wise that maybe we could get Kid Rock and Nugent here.
Yeah,
and then maybe it'll move down the road to Dover Bay or something, and you know they'll be able to do it again. And I shouldn't joke about it, but the last few lineups of the festival I've really enjoyed. And there's just no real reason why that should end. It's like the people that show up to the library to yell at people for enforcing a mask mandate. It's just like, do you not have jobs? Do you not have something better to do with your time? You know, I understand that you might have a position on the matter, but you know, why do you got to mess with this thing? It's a nice thing. People enjoy it.
Okay, we got to move on to another topic. Keith, why don't you give us a story you think was a big one that we haven't touched on yet?
You know, it's hard to outrun the pandemic. I think the county, how it's positioning itself, and you know, it seemed like the city was in a pretty... They seem to be taking things head on when the pandemic first started. And they wanted to make sure that the safeguards were, if they needed to be, more stringent than the state's safeguards. But they've kind of receded. I don't really see them talking about it too much. And then the county, obviously, we know kind of where they're at on it. But I think, you know, until, you know, I think we're just going to, unfortunately, see more of the same from our local officials as long as this, you know, persists. And I have a feeling, and I'm not trying to be pessimistic or fatalistic, but I think it's going to be, I think it's going to linger around for a lot longer than people think. And then I think that the politics around that will just calibrate. And it's kind of unfortunate because, like I was saying before, it's a one or a two. You either believe this thing is happening or you don't. And there's not a whole lot of, you know, middle ground for people to actually have a constructive debate about it. And I think that's a shame. But I'm just hoping that kind of getting back to the festival thing, that will resolve itself and that we can kind of get back to having a good time at the festival and not have it be a political football. I mean, it's just so stupid because it's a good thing for our community and we're fighting over it. It just doesn't need to be happening. And I didn't mean to double back on the festival, but here we are.
Yeah, well, it is a major thing for the town. Ben, give us a story that we haven't touched on yet that was big in 2020.
I think there were a lot of stories that slipped by because of the gun lawsuit, because of COVID, because of the election. One thing that I had on my notes was that this was not technically a bad wildfire year for North Idaho, but it was a terrible smoky sky year, as they have been the last 5 to 10 years. And I think that this kind of goes into the predictions for you know, the year ahead or the years ahead. I'm just noticing a lot more high wind events. I'm noticing a lot more days of smoky skies. We had, you know, we were cresting 500 on the air index a couple of those days, as was most of the West. And I think that we need to start coming to terms with the fact that this is kind of what's going to happen every year. Fire season's going to be more severe. It's going to probably start a little earlier. It's probably going to go a little later. And so I think that the smoke event and the wildfire period this year was just one of those things that people shook their head and just said, "Oh, 2020, you know, but you know, it's not 2020. It's been going on every year and it's going to get even worse.
And it didn't used to. You can speak as a longtime guy here. It didn't used to be like this. Actually, the smoke we used to be struggling with was from grass field burning down in down south. And now we're coming to feel like we're always going to be inflicted by this smoke. That didn't happen so much last year. And one thing I noticed about this year is we really made it most of the way through the summer, and then it hit us right at the end of August, I think it was. And it wasn't even, as you said, Ben, wasn't even local fires. We're getting fires from around the Northwest. They had huge fires in Washington and Oregon, and even California smoke was coming up here.
Yeah, and that's important to note. You know, it's not just a state that needs to react to this stuff. It's the federal government needs to understand that when California is burning, you know, the whole western half of the United States is under terrible air conditions. And it's not just about forest management or raking the forest floors or any of the other euphemisms that are used. It's about climate change, and it's about getting on top of it and coming to terms with it. And maybe the first step is just acknowledging reality, you know, and saying that this is happening and there are ways to reverse it. And I hope that, you know, with the incoming administration, I think I do hope that we come to terms with reality a little bit more when it comes to climate change, that it's not going to be an economic you know, punch in the face. It can actually help. We can actually build our economy more with renewable energy.
Yeah. And the forest management practices play a role in what we're seeing, I believe, as well. So, we're about out of time here. Let's swing by and get from each of you a good guess on something that's going to be a big story in 2021, something people want to watch out for. And Lindsay, believe it or not, you had your hand up there.
I have something. I want to be on the record saying that this is going to be big. So the last 3 years, the proposed Newport smelter has been big in the news, right? People want to know more about it. There's people on both sides of it. And then there's also the very active, I'm going to forget their name right now, but the anti-smelter group. They have a special name. Cairns, yes. Yep. So Cairns is, they've been a little quiet this year because if you remember back in February, the CEO of PacWest, Jason Timko, came out and said it's on hold. Because what is the real issue here is that the property that they bought to build the smelter on is not zoned for industrial uses at the current moment. So what PacWest is really waiting for is for Ponderay County to come out with their new comprehensive plan. And they are anticipating, it seems, because they bought the property, they're anticipating that the comprehensive plan is going to end up changing the zoning of their property. So smelter's been on hold this year. Lots of public meetings have been on hold because of COVID. But Ponderay County is back to discussing their comprehensive plan, and that's going to ramp up in 2021. And the anti-smelter people are on top of it, and they are at every one of those meetings keeping an eye on this. So it's going to be really interesting to see that develop over the next year. And I'm calling it right now that we're going to be writing stories about the smelter.
Okay, Lindsay, thank you. Ben, what do you got for 2021?
Nothing good. No, I'm just kidding. I think that 2021 is going to, honestly, I think that politics in North Idaho are going to get even nuttier, if that's possible. I don't think that, you know, Trump out of the White House is going to fix our own brand of crazy that we have up here. I think that we, like I said earlier, I think that we lionize the outspoken and loudmouth politicians who rise above the nuts and bolts aspect of the job and become kind of their own cults of personality. And I do think that we're going to see some legislation that's going to be a result of that. Last year, there was the trans bills, I forget the numbers of them. They were both called by the Idaho AG as unconstitutional. Idaho passed anyway. Governor Little signed in law, and as everybody guessed, they were shot down by a federal court as unconstitutional. And I think that we're going to have a few more of those type of bills come up and be taken into law. And I think that the gun lawsuit is going to continue to be a primary story this year. And I also think Bonner County is going to fight. Or City of Sandpoint was awarded $70,000 of their legal fees as a result of that first lawsuit. And I think Bonner County is going to appeal that as far as they can and probably throw another, you know, $20,000-$30,000 of effort into avoiding paying that $70,000, bringing the total county bill probably upwards of $300,000 for that lawsuit, which is substantial.
All right, Keith, close us out with what you prognosticate for 2021.
I think one of the things that's coming up here is the county's waterfront setback ordinance. The county is talking about modifying it, and it's kind of been a reliable standard by which people would develop by. And I would hate to see that change. And I don't care how they church it up, the county, I mean, on why they want to change it and that sort of thing. I think they just want to loosen the development standard. And I think that would be a real shame because water is Bonner County's lifeblood. It's why people come here. And I think that the county commission has the planning department on a singular mission to basically get rid of all of its bureaucracy, red tape, what have you. But I think that would be a huge mistake to allow change. And you can even see it in the number of variances that come through the county, where people are already basically asking to sidestep that design standard. And you know, they're largely getting their way if they apply for it. So hopefully some people will come out and oppose that and be able to make a coherent argument. I mean, it's pretty simple. I mean, just don't build in the 40-foot setback. I think that hearing's coming up later next month. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out.
Well, there you go. That's an issue for people to definitely watch for in the coming year if they're concerned about water quality in our lake and rivers and streams. Well, with that, we're out of time. I want to say thank you again, Keith Kennard from Daily Bee and Ben Olson and Lindsay Cabert from the Sandpoint Reader. Appreciate your insights. We could keep going, but the clock says we're time's up. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.